This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Joseph Osmundson is a molecular biologist at New York University, and he's written extensively about COVID-19. Recently, The New Yorker's Carolyn Cormon asked him to explain some of the new and scary questions about the virus as it develops.
I wanted to talk about some of the stuff we're seeing in the news, and we're now dealing with not just one, but two strains of the original coronavirus we know so well. And these strains are distinct. Could you break down for me on a really kind of granular level, how often does this virus, SARS-CoV-2, mutate?
You know, biology is never perfect. And so everything is going to make mistakes. Your cell sometimes makes mistakes when it copies all of its DNA. A virus will inevitably mutate. And those mutations are, so we call them the raw material of evolution, right? So if there are differences in the genetic sequence of a virus, those differences can have phenotypic differences, which just means differences in how the virus acts. Does it, you know, replicate faster? Does it replicate more in certain cells? You know, and the more transmission that occurs, the more people the virus is in, the more chances it has to change. Right. So this is yet again a reason why, you know, the NPIs, the non-pharmaceutical interventions, social distancing is so important. This virus is worrisome. I will say that it is for sure worrisome, in part because of the number of mutations it has. It has 23 total mutations.
That's a surprise to scientists.
It is. And we actually, the leading hypothesis of how the virus may have emerged, we know that, you know, most people, an individual gets COVID, they spend a couple days not yet feeling sick, but they're infectious, then they may shed virus for another 8 to 10 days after that. And then, you know, it's an RNA virus. It doesn't stick around in your body. Even if you're testing positive after that 10 days, we think the vast majority of people, the virus is not actively replicating and they're not infectious. But we know for sure that people with compromised immune systems can actually replicate the virus for a much longer period of time, right? So up to 70 days. So one infection, an individual has shed virus for 70 days if they're immunocompromised. And that is actually that person's immune system over a long period of time putting a lot of pressure on the virus to mutate, right? So that's the type of situation we think where these strains with so many mutations in them may evolve. It's kind of an atypical infection in an individual.
Wow. So you're saying that the variant with 23 mutations most likely came from a person. It evolved in a person or a series of people who were immunocompromised.
That seems to be the leading hypothesis. We certainly don't have data. We haven't found that individual. And we don't have sort of the genetic sleuthery to trace it back exactly to that. But if you look at the number of mutations, that's the most sort of likely theory to why this type of evolution could occur.
And this new strain first emerged in September, maybe, and it seemingly has spread all over southern England and throughout London very quickly. It seems that most new cases are this strain.
The way the epidemiological data work is that you basically quantify how much of the viral transmission, how many new cases come from the variant, the new strain, or the typical, what we would call a wild type virus. And the pattern that they saw is that this variant seems to spread through the population quite rapidly. And this certainly is raising everyone's alarm bells.
Okay. And at this point, especially in this country, we don't know how long it's been here or how much it's spreading.
That's right. So we really don't have a good idea of how much of it is here. We think, based on some very preliminary studies, that it's not super duper widespread. It is, of course, worrying that the individuals found to have this variant have no history of travel to the UK. We are not sequencing enough viruses, right? This was found by an incredible work in the UK to say, we need to take 5% or 10% of the people who test positive for SARS-CoV-2 and sequence every letter in the genome of that virus and to try to look for exactly this type of thing. Some analysis that the science advocacy group I work with and I have been doing shows that only a couple of states in 2020 even have 1% or 2% of their cases sequenced. Many states have none. And many states where there's tons and tons of transmission has very sparse sequencing. So we would not be finding this if it were here. It is here, and we don't really know how widespread it is. I find it really, as a virologist, this type of evolution is both terrifying and interesting. But what it means for people is not anything new. We need to stop transmitting this virus. Because right. This virus might be more transmissible, and that could actually lead to a really horrific outcome in terms of the number of deaths. Some sort of back of the envelope math show that a virus that's more transmissible will actually cause more deaths than a virus that's more deadly, because it's exponential the way it spreads.
Oh, wow.
So okay. It is.
So it's potentially very bad news. If it's more transmissible.
If preliminary data on transmissibility hold up and we are slow at vaccine rollout and we don't get better at non-pharmaceutical interventions like wearing masks, we could be in for a world of hurt. You know, I think fundamentally we need to be doing the same things that we should have been doing all along, and we need really fast vaccine rollout. Right. So if this thing is more transmissible, but the vaccine still works, and we really hope and think that it likely still will, the faster we get the vaccine to people, the more we can start turning down the transmission, even of a more infectious virus. The good news, and this is data we've had already since the spring, is that vaccination tends to produce a more consistent and robust immune response than does disease. So that is really good news. Are you still going to be protected against this new variant? We have no reason to believe that you won't. So we think so. I would say the other good news about the vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, as you know, are mRNA vaccines, which means that we can actually just take the mRNA that we put in the vaccine and give it the new version of the spike protein from the new virus.
That could happen very quickly.
Right. So if we find that the virus has escaped the vaccine, we could swap that in quickly.
Right. This conversation will continue just in terms of how much mask wearing, social distancing, and other measures will be necessary for everyone until really we get to about 75% of the population vaccinated. Do you agree with that?
I would say even then. I think COVID is going to be with us for a very long time. It might take more than a year to get to 75%. COVID tests and COVID diagnoses, I think, will happen occasionally, even when we get to 75%, because you will never have 100% of people vaccinated. You'll always have travel around the globe. We see from history that we don't eradicate infectious diseases with vaccines very well. It's only ever happened with smallpox. Only. Right? And so I think that history tells us that both the vaccine will make things immeasurably better. I cannot wait to be vaccinated. Does that mean I won't ever think about COVID risk diagnosis, wearing masks? No, I still will even then.
I am curious what kind of faith you have that people will keep up social distancing once they start hearing more and more people they know have been vaccinated.
I don't think we have done well communicating to people how to manage risk. I'm a queer scientist. I was born in 1983, the year HIV was identified as the virus that causes AIDS. Risk management has been a part of my upbringing and culture since I was a child. And I don't think we've done well to communicate how exhausting that is to people, but how much that type of thinking saves lives. It was not a joy growing up to worry about HIV every time I had sex and to feel like if I don't wear a condom, I might die. And yet that was part of how we cared for each other. It's not fun, but it is a way to care.
Well, it was wonderful speaking with you, Joe. Thank you so much. And good luck with all your work.
I feel more energized now than when we started the conversation. So I think that's a marker that it's done something for me. Thank you so much.
Same. Thank you.
Joseph Osmundson is a molecular biologist at New York University. He spoke with staff writer Carolyn Cormon.